Thank you very much. So today I'll be talking about this paper that we called Co-Decaying Dark Matter. It's, as Maxim said, a very recent paper. It's only a few days ago, so I'm very excited about it. And if you want to talk about this more afterwards, of course, I'll be around. So we should chat if you're interested. But basically, the idea is that it's a new freeze-out mechanism for dark matter. And the basic plot, and I'll describe this in a lot of detail as the talk goes on, but the idea is, suppose you have two particles in your sector, in your dark sector, A and B, and only part of the dark sector decays. So in this case, I drew it as B decaying into the standard model. So the question is, how does the so the question is then, how does having these two processes impact the relic density? And it's similar in spirit to co-annihilation, and I'll also describe that analogy quite a bit as well. So here's a general outline of my talk. First, I'll give an experimental overview about WIMPs in particular and how where we stand from the three frontiers, which are which have been probing dark matter for quite a little while now, direct detection, indirect detection, and collider searches. And I'll explain why, at least in my opinion, it's really time to start thinking about some alternative freeze-out mechanisms and see how else dark matter could be in this universe. Then I'll discuss co-decay, which is the general, mechanism that I wanted to go over in a lot of detail, but I'll discuss the basics of it and how this can play out and what conditions have to hold in order to have this mechanism. Then I'll show a computation of the relic density. It's in fact very similar to the spirit in which we can compute the relic density of the WIMP in a few lines. You could repeat this also here for this mechanism, and I think it's quite intuitive to see how that works out. Then I'll go over the Boltzmann equations. The Boltzmann equations for this scenario is a little bit more intricate than for the WIMP, and I'll describe why and how that plays out and how you can overcome the challenges associated with solving the Boltzmann equations and how we did it. Then I'll discuss the parameter space in which co-decay takes place. The parameter space is there's a lot of theoretical and experimental constraints on where this sort of thing can live, and I want to go over what those are and in what scenarios you can have this sort of paradigm. And then I want to go into effect of a mass splitting. So I quickly commented in the beginning that I'll assume a degenerate dark sector of these two A and B particles. But in fact, in any real scenario, probably have some sort of small mass splitting. And I want to go over what is the effect of that and in what situations it's important, what situations it can be neglected. And lastly, I want to go over an explicit model. So I'll be focusing on a toy model, but then I want to go over something more intuitive or more complete, I should say. Okay, so what is the story here to detect a WIMP? You guys have probably seen this sort of plot in the past. The basic idea is that in the early universe, we had these dark matter particles, chi, and they annihilated into the standard model. That's the WIMP paradigm. And the dark matter particles were in chemical equilibrium with the standard model, and you had these processes happening back and forth in the early universe. Now, this is the direction that's happened in the early universe, or that's most important in the early universe. But in fact, quantum field theory tells us we have crossing symmetry. If you're going to have something in one direction, you better have it also in the other directions, up to phase-space contributions. So in general, we're going to have all three different channels that you can look for. And that's what people have done, and that motivated this program of different detection mechanisms. There's direct detection, which is going to be in this direction, where a chi scatters off a standard model particle, typically in some sort of liquid xenon, for example, or other types of materials as well. And this puts really tight constraints, especially on the high mass region where you really want WIMPs to live. So that's really the most powerful constraint on the classic WIMP scenario at the moment. Now, we also have indirect detection. That takes you from this direction over here. And what this probes, or why it's nice, is because it probes the mechanism that took place in the early universe. It's the direction that was really depleting the dark sector in the early universe. So in some sense, it's actually a very, so it's a very complementary and very interesting way to probe dark matter. Lastly, there's collider searches, which just mean standard model particles creating these dark matter particles. And these searches are in themselves very less powerful than direct detection. But on the other hand, they also probe the motivation for WIMPs. We expect WIMPs to come with additional particles. And I'll go over why, in fact, there's two types of collider searches which are related to WIMPs, and how this is, and they're both very important in their own right, as to why we should care about WIMPs or not, depending on the results. Okay, so first of all, direct detection. You guys have probably seen plots like this in the past. This here plots you the WIMP nucleon cross-section on the y-axis. On the x-axis, we have the mass of the dark matter particle. This gives you pretty powerful limits. So we're talking about pretty powerful limits when you have dark matter around a TeV scale. So here we have roughly a TeV over here, so we're seeing we have some limits here. Now this is a slightly outdated plot. So some of these things, these curves over here, these projections are dashed, and today they should be solid, but in reality we have not seen a signal, so it doesn't really matter what we're probably looking at, but either way. So when you look at this plot, you might not be very aware of what this means. This is actually hard to see, but this is about 10 to the negative 42 over here on the cross-sections that we're ruling out. But what does that even mean in terms of fundamental parameters or in terms of an actual model? Most of you are probably not comfortable with these units, at least I was not, especially not in terms of a fundamental model framework. So I took some random model, which has a pretty simple possibility for dark matter, where you have some additional chi's, which will be your dark matter, and they annihilate into standard model fermions through some sort of Z prime portal. And the Z prime has some sort of mixing with the standard model Z. So this was discussed in some detail in this paper, but the basic idea, that's the basic story here, and there's a bunch of parameters. Just for illustration, I just chose them ad hoc to be these numbers over here. Now, if you take this model, you can go ahead and look at the formulas provided in this paper, and you get this line over here matched onto this plot. So we have some prediction for the WIMP nucleon cross-section. Now, in order to get the correct the correct rock density today, that also implies a particular cross-section in this direction, in the indirect detection direction, and that puts you at a particular point in the plot. So we actually, this little red dot here corresponds to that point that you get the correct thermally average cross-section. So if you compare this to where the constraints currently are, Lux here is the most popular, or is the most recent one, and that one just about starting to rule out this model. And that's currently the status of these direct detection searches. They're just about starting to rule out these WIMPs. There's all different kinds. There's some WIMP models which have been ruled out for a long time already, and some that are being probed right now. But it all depends on your parameters and your choices. But in general, there's starting to be quite a bit of pressure on the most naive WIMP models. The other detection mechanism that I want to discuss is the indirect detection. And these are constraining particularly if you have low mass or velocity-dependent cross-sections. Sorry, these are constraining if you have low mass velocity-independent cross-sections. Here you see some sample from AMS data, AMS-02. It's some telescope looking at for dark matter or looking for other things, but also dark matter lines and spectra. And here you see the constraints on the thermally average cross-sections in the sky for different possible indirect detection signals. So annihilations to electrons, gluons, etc. And now we're looking at values about 10 to the negative 24 centimeters cubed per second. Again, it's not really intuitive what this really means, so I took the same model that we had from last time, the Z prime model, and then plotted the prediction for the thermally averaged cross-sections. Now, in this case, we see here that in the higher mass range, there's no exclusions at all from this these measurements. So anything beyond this point is completely not excluded. Everything below the curve is not excluded. So these are not excluded at all by these searches. And this is just a typical thing where you have, for lower mass particles, we have less annihilations in these dark matter clouds, and we have less signal for this indirect detection signatures. Also, I should mention here that I also wanted to plot to the rock density point in this plot, but unfortunately, it's below the curve, so it's actually quite a bit away from the current sensitivities. Next is the collider bounds, and there's really two classes of collider bounds. Some are directly looking for dark matter, these mono X searches. What they do is they look for standard model colliding, producing dark matter particles, and to tag these things, they also need some sort of initial state particle, potentially a jet or a photon, whatever this X would be whatever that search is. Now these are constraining for light dark matter, and a more subtle point is that they constrain spin-dependent cross-sections better than you can do at direct detection experiments. And they have constraints in the order of about 300 GeV. So they're on the lower end of the constraints, but they are starting to attack this sort of parameter space. Now, there's another class of experiments that are run looking for dark matter in some sense at the LHC. And these are the ones that look for the byproducts associated with dark matter. The whole reason why we got excited about the WIMPs is because they predicted the electroweak scale from an independent place as the hierarchy problem. If the WIMPs were interesting because you found another motivation to find physics at the TV scale, but we're not finding these physics. We expected to find Susie and these lovely stop diagrams producing jets and MET and all that stuff, but we're simply not finding it so far. One example is the stops. We expected them to be, let's say, around the top mass, but they're not. They're at least at around 800 GeV. Well, depends on the detailed final state, but they're around the constraints are around 500 GeV to a TeV. The gliadinos are much worse than that. They're about 2 TeV almost, depending on the final state. But nevertheless, it's certainly true that we're not seeing the plethora of particles that we were expecting to see very close to the electroweak scale. So this by itself lowers your motivation for why we even care about WIMPs. Because the fundamental reason why we got excited about them was because they predicted the electroweak scale. If we're not seeing any solution to the hierarchy problem at a TeV, then it really should reduce your faith in this WIMP paradigm. So the question is then, what do you do given with this, this set of data? We haven't found any signals from any sort of searches so far. What sort of thing do you, what's the current trajectory for our field in dark matter research? Now, one option is just keep trying to do what you're doing, or keep trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. You know, the data is telling us it's not going to be, you're not going to find, or there's no dark matter existent in the current strategies. But maybe it's still there. We don't know. So the current strategy could be to just keep pushing hard in that direction and see where it takes you. Maybe we'll find something, and it'll be very useful. But on the other hand, it's very possible that dark matter is not connected at all to the hierarchy problem, and the WIMP miracle is just a miracle by coincidence. And in that case, we should really try to consider stopping to connect the hierarchy problem to dark matter. It's really not the only way to go, and there's a variety of other things you could do. And I claim to be a very useful and fruitful exercise as well. Now, if you forget about the hierarchy problem, it opens up a lot of possibilities for dark matter, stuff that you did not appreciate when you were so focused on neutralinos for WIMP and WIMPs and that sort of direction. One possibility is a hidden sector. So instead of having one particle, which you designate as your dark matter particle, you now have a whole slew of new particles. And this gives the idea that maybe we have some new alternative dark matter freeze-out mechanisms. So instead of having the regular thermal dark matter story that we'd have for WIMPs, we can have some alternative scenarios. And that's kind of what I want to discuss in a lot of detail. Now, you might be concerned because we are dropping one of the fundamental assumptions when talking about dark matter. So you lose predictivity in some sense. We no longer have a prediction that WIMPs should be within so-so range. So in that sense, it's quite scary. But on the other hand, as we'll see, there's still a lot of constraints, and there's a lot of movement right now in the experimental field that we could really try to constrain this parameter space, even without being constrained to a certain mass range that WIMPs tell us to be. So this has been a program that's been around for a little while now. Here you see some of the alternative mechanisms that have gained some traction and some that are just relatively new. Let me just go over what some of those are. I'm going to focus on these thermal candidates. There's other ones which are also non-thermal, which are equally as interesting. But nevertheless, here are some of the ones that have gained popularity. There's the co-annihilation story, which has been around for a while now. That tells you that you have multiple particles that are around the same mass, and they need to freeze out at the same time. You have to incorporate both particles when computing your dark matter relic density. And I'll go over that in a little bit of detail. There's the ones that involve number-changing processes. There's the SIMP, the Elder, and Cannibal dark matter, all that are around this direction. There's secluded dark matter, which Maxime worked on for quite a little while. He it was about in 2008, I think. Basically, the story there is that you introduce an additional particles that these the dark matter can decay into or to annihilate with that are much lighter. And that changes the story quite a bit. Then we can also have asymmetric dark matter, which is very popular. It provides an explanation for why the baryon density is roughly equivalent or roughly equal to the dark matter density today. And we also have semi-annihilation and forbidden, which are interesting in their own right. I'll go a little bit more into forbidden, actually, at the end of the talk as well. So before I move on to discussing what I really want to talk about, I want to set the stage here with the WIMP freeze-out paradigm, hopefully to set notation and also to set the general framework that I'm interested in. So for the WIMP, what you have is you have a chemical equilibrium with a standard model in the early universe. That's the fundamental assumption. We have some processes that are keeping the dark matter in equilibrium with the standard model. Now, as temperature of the universe cools down below the mass of the particle, then something very important happens. Dark matter becomes non-relativistic. Once you become non-relativistic and you're in equilibrium with the standard model, then you're going to be Boltzmann suppressed. Just like a regular, any sort of statistical mechanical system, when you drop below this mass, you're going to be Boltzmann suppressed. And that means that the number density will begin to drop, as shown over here. So basically, you have this exponential suppression, e to the minus x, which will deplete your dark sector very rapidly. Now, this will continue on. However, at some point, the number of collisions that are happening between the dark matter particles drops below Hubble. So the rate of collisions, when particles cannot find other particles to annihilate with in a fast enough rate, then this process of annihilating into the standard model will cease to happen. And at that point, we say the dark matter density is frozen out. And then we get a dark matter density scaling just like a regular redshift. So just to see this a little bit more diagrammatically, very high energies, dark matter is relativistic. This n prime denotes the dark matter number density. It'll scale like t cubed. Once you cross the mass threshold of the dark matter mass, then you will be Boltzmann suppressed, and at some point you will redshift until today after freeze out. And I'll denote different quantities x, which is just m divided by the temperature. Any sort of quantity with a subscript denotes that quantity evaluated at that temperature. So h sub t denotes Hubble evaluated at temperature t, et cetera. So if you go ahead with this mindset and then go ahead and compute the relic density today, this is the quantity shown over here, defined as the density today divided by the critical density. And the number density today is just given by the solution to this sort of equation. It's just the number density. It's just the mass times the number density at freeze-out, redshifted by these ratio of entropies. And if you go ahead and rewrite this using your freeze-out condition that tells you that n sigma v is equal to Hubble, you can get this expression over here. Now, if you look at this, there's an expression in brackets. That one is roughly independent of mass. It's just some quantity, some number that you can go ahead and compute very easily. Then you have some xf. That's the temperature, or the inverse of the temperature at freeze-out. And then you have 1 over sigma v at freeze-out. Xf is roughly equal to 20 in the WIMP scenario. It just tells you that at roughly 20, that's when the dark matter stops annihilating or cannot find another dark matter to annihilate with. And then that means that you effectively fixed your relic density for a given cross-section. And that was the exciting point of the whole WIMP paradigm, is that if you go ahead and you plug in numbers now, you'll find that sigma v needs to be around a picobarn. So that means that picobarn, and picobarn is really where we expect electroweak cross-sections. So this was the really exciting point, and that's why people got excited about the WIMP paradigm. Now, there are many variations of this story. This is just the most standard way to discuss this. But there are many variations of this, and they're almost all driven by Boltzmann suppression. So the key point is that you have chemical equilibrium with the standard model, and then you find that at some point you will be depleting the dark sector because of Boltzmann suppression. And now I want to go over an alternative scenario to this. So the first question is that you should be asking yourself, well, what if dark matter is part of a larger sector? I now told you that I don't want to care about the hierarchy problem. I want to think more generally about what possibilities there are for dark matter. Now, the usual assumption here is that even if dark matter is part of a larger sector, you can just forget about all the particles but the lightest one when discussing the relic density. And that's a pretty good assumption. Everything will just Boltzmann suppress until the dark matter candidate, and then at that point you can just worry about dark matter candidate when discussing freeze-out. But there's a famous counterexample to this philosophy, and that's co-annihilation. And that tells you when you have particles that are of similar mass, you can no longer ignore these particles or the heavier particles when computing the relic density. You have to include all of them. And here's just a simple pictorial picture how that looks like. Suppose you have some particle A. It has annihilation into some other particle B. and B can then annihilate into the standard model. If you were going to ignore B completely in this discussion, then you think that A could never turn into the standard model, it can never get the correct Brock density. But that's not the case. It can annihilate in this two-step process to produce the standard model. Now, the details here will certainly change. This sort of story gave life to the MSSM, or a lot of parameter space to the MSSM a little while back. But the general picture is very similar to the WIMP paradigm. Nothing dramatic changes here. We still have Bolson suppression, and we still have a similar story to tell. So the other possibility is that maybe annihilations to the standard model are just small. It's not the only way to connect to the standard model. You can connect in some other way. What if you have some small coupling that connects your standard model to your dark sector? Now, in this case, you can have a dominant, the dominant connection to your dark sector could be a decay instead of an annihilation. And the question is, then, how do things play out? So it turns out that the thermal history, based on these assumptions, is largely dependent on your decay rate. As we'll see, if the decay rate is large or smaller than Hubble, evaluated at M, you'll have very dramatic differences in your phenomenology. And here you see the basic picture that we're after here. Suppose A's and B's can annihilate into each other and back, and B's can decay into some other standard model state, say gamma-gamma. This is kind of the story that we want to explore. And I'll assume throughout that A's and B's are degenerate and in line with the co-annihilation assumption. And later I'll justify that in a full model framework as well.
This is what happens with the charged pions.
Yes, but the decay there is very fast. So this is going to be the scenario. And then that'll give you a very different story than if the decay is slow. That's right. So first we'll consider the case where the decay is fast. And the question is, what happens? So in this case, inverse decays are also fast. So you can decay into some final state in the case of the standard model, but the inverse decays will also be very important. These are going to keep the dark sector in chemical equilibrium with the standard model, even when it's non-relativistic. So we can have these B decays to gamma-gamma. We can also have gamma-gamma decays or inverse decays into B. So the question is, how will things look like in this scenario? Well, in this case, B will remain in equilibrium with the standard model, and A will remain in equilibrium with the standard model because it's in chemical equilibrium with B. So in the end of the day, everything is going to be similar because you're in equilibrium with the standard model. So the number density of these A's will then drop exponentially. You'll have Bolson suppression, and this is qualitatively very similar to co-annihilation. Nothing dramatic is happening here because you're in chemical equilibrium with the standard model. The other possibility is you have a slow decay. By slow here, I mean that the rate is much smaller than Hubble, evaluated at the mass of the particle. Now, in this case, inverse decays are also slow. So you no longer have the inverse process keeping you in equilibrium. You just have some decays at some point later on. This means that you're going to be decoupled from the standard model quite early on. And in this case, nothing happens when the temperature of the universe crosses the mass of the particle. There's no dramatic depletion of your dark sector like you do in the previous slide. On the other hand, at some point later, this exponential, e to the minus gamma t, will become large. When this exponential is roughly equal to 1, you'll begin to deplete your dark sector, and this depletion will happen at a different rate than the Boltzmann case. Instead, here you'll have an e to the minus gamma t depletion, and that can be rewritten in terms of x, the temperature variable, roughly as e to the minus gamma over h at m times x squared. So instead of e to the minus x, we now have an e to the minus x squared depletion of the dark sector. And this is a story that we've been calling co-decaying dark matter. So this is emphasize the point here. I want to go over the steps in the same way that I went over for the WIMP. Now, at very high or at very early times or high temperatures, we're over here. The standard model will decouple from the dark sector. Once the temperature of the universe crosses the mass of the particles, nothing happens. Throughout this whole period, we still have chemical equilibrium between A's and B's, so that's happening rapidly. Now, at some point, this temperature will call T gamma. That's when e to the minus gamma T is roughly equal to 1. At this point, the B's are going to start decaying, and these decays will deplete the B sector.
Or the temperature in the
In the visible sector. So I'll go over, actually, it's true that there's different temperatures, and I'll discuss that in detail, actually. So the Bs will start decaying at this time, T gamma. And because the As are in chemical equilibrium with the standard model, or sorry, with the Bs, the As are in chemical equilibrium with the Bs, so that will cause the As to annihilate into Bs once the B population drops. And that'll mean that there's going to be an A to B process that's going to be annihilating the Bs will be annihilating the As and depleting the A population. Now, at some point, the As will no longer be able to find other As to annihilate with, and the As will freeze out. This is now in the exact same spirit as what happened in the WIMP paradigm, but it's happening at a much different time. It's happening at this time T gamma, which in principle, this is having a temperature T gamma, which in principle can be much after the temperature at the mass of the particles. Now, there's a new parameter involved here. So the WIMP paradigm has one parameter that we're dependent on, which is the cross section. Here we have an additional rate that we're also dependent on. And there is also dependence on the mass as well. So now I want to go over how the relic density is computed for this scenario. The relic density equation is in fact identical to the one that I presented to you about 10 slides ago. It's just this thing over here. It's just some number shown in brackets, this some number that's effectively fixed, just some number independent of the details, times this xf, which is effectively the temperature at freezeout, divided by this thermally averaged cross-section at freezeout. If we have an S wave, which is the possibility that I'll focus on for the sake of this talk, then this thermally averaged cross-section goes like this. It's some constant sigma divided by the square root of x prime, where x prime is the inverse of the temperature of the dark sector. So prime quantities throughout will denote the dark temperatures. You might be a little bit upset about this. Normally we say that S wave is independent of velocity, but the point is here that we're having interactions between particles that are of the same mass, and that'll mean that you have to have some kind of velocity suppression because of the sigma v. Now, I think I emphasized it, but let me just say it again. The temperature of the dark sector is not equal to the temperature of the standard model, so it's very important to keep track of these two things separately, and I'll discuss that in the next couple of slides as well. So here's the relic density equation. We have some quantity in brackets. This thing, again, is independent of the details, and here we have the relic density, or the important piece over here. So in order to compute your relic density for a given model, you need to get two things. You need to get your temperature at freezeout of your standard model, as well as your dark temperature at freezeout. So the goal is to track your dark sector between decoupling and until freezeout. So we'll start by finding TF, in other words, the temperature at freezeout of the standard model. And to this end, we should really also get, or we need to get, the number density for the dark sector at freezeout. The easiest way to do this is just compute the number density at the time t gamma, this n gamma prime, redshift it by some ratio of scale factors. That just tells you that while the dynamics is happening, the universe is also expanding. And then multiply by this exponential, e to the minus gamma t, up to some small factors here. And that can be written roughly as this, e to the minus gamma over h and m, x squared. This is the piece that will exponentially deplete your dark sector. These pieces end up being actually unimportant for the purposes of this talk. They'll appear inside a log. Basically, what happens is, this is your freeze-out equation. NF prime sigma v is roughly equal to Hubble. You stick in this expression over here into here, and you solve it. Now, all that matters is when the exponential is roughly equal to 1, everything else appears inside a log. This is, again, similar to what happens in the WIMP scenario. You can drop almost all the dependences if you just care about the leading behavior. And this is what we have for xf. It's just when this thing is equal to 1. So we have a 1 over square root of gamma h at m, over h at m times some log. Now this log is not necessarily tiny. So it's about order 10. But again, for to get the general behavior, it's not particularly important. The point is that we have some temperature which we start decaying at. That's effectively the thing outside the log. And the log pushes your xf beyond that to some additional, about a factor of 10 past that. So that's TF. That's the first ingredient we need to get the correct rock density. Now let's get the dark temperature. And to this end, let's track the dark temperature as a function of...
Yeah. So when the things start decaying, the inverse process, the production of B, is it important?
No, no. So the inverse process, in principle, would only be important when density is very, very large in the first place. So it's actually never important, even...
So what mass are you imagining for the B particles? So the M is the mass of the A.
Okay. So I'm imagining they're completely degenerate.
MA
is equal to MB. That's right. So in the end, I'll talk about the effect of a splitting. But for this purposes, they're identical.
Are you going to have some period of matter domination?
That's a very good question. So we can indeed have matter domination, and it affects the results by order one, and I'll discuss that also. But yeah, it certainly can happen. Yes. So we want to find this dark temperature T prime. When T is, let's go over the timeline for how things look. So when you're relativistic, the dark temperature is going to scale this exact same way as a standard model temperature. Nothing special is happening. It's just a relativistic bath. Now in that case, but once you cross the mass of the particle, the number density or the co-moving number density needs to be conserved. And if that happens, that requires the dark temperature to start scaling a little bit differently. It'll scale as T squared of the standard model. This is a well-known result. It's also, you can find this in Kolben-Turner, but it's basically what it tells you is that the chemical potential is, or you start developing a chemical potential to keep the co-moving number density constant as a function of time between past when the system becomes non-relativistic. So you have this redshift, this factor T squared over M squared. Now, once you cross T gamma, then, or in other words, when the decay starts happening, you still have about the same behavior. So T prime will still scale in the exact same way. Now this thing over here, this T squared over T gamma squared, I told you is going to be small. It's just XF divided by that. It's just a log in my previous slide. So this is effectively just given by this quantity over here. So you can rewrite this as X prime at freezeout is roughly equal to XF squared times some log. And the square just comes from right over here. So we have now all the ingredients to compute the rock density. But I want to quickly pause here and compute the case if we have number-changing processes. So it's a little bit subtle, but in fact, in any realistic system, you're going to also have number-changing processes that can become very important. And the point is that now we have a very large number density at late times. And when that happens, you can develop 4-to-2 or 3-to-2 processes that are going to heat up your dark sector. So I want to discuss this possibility. And in any realistic scenario, you'll actually have some bit of cannibalization and some bit without cannibalization. But the point is that you kind of want to understand these two limiting cases. And any realistic scenario will be a combination of the two. So here we have processes like this. Let's say A is a 3-to-2 process for A to B. We can also have 4-to-2, which will be important, et cetera. Now these processes have been well known, or the effect has been well known for a long time. Basically, it stops the dark sector from cooling. We say that the dark matter is cannibalizing to keep itself warm, and that's the effect of these processes. Now, if this is going to happen, so at very early times, when the universe is very hot, we'll still have that the temperature of the dark sector is roughly equal to the temperature of the standard model. Nothing special will happen. Once you cross the mass of the dark matter particles, then the temperature of the dark sector will not drop like it did before. Instead, it will be roughly equal to the mass of the particle times some log. And this log is associated with these 3-to-2 or 4-to-2 processes. Now, at some point later, T gamma, T prime will scale in a simple way, because at this point, T gamma, we lose the law of our number density, and we're back to the position that we were before, where we just have a redshift. But this, again, is some sort of, I said, small effect, again, an order log effect. So if you go ahead and compute your temperature today, at freezeout of your dark sector, you get some log associated with these factors, some log over here, and you'll find that XF prime is roughly equal to a log. So it's an order one number. So we have two different cases, and the effects here are going to be quite different, and it'll lead to different scaling in the final results. So here's the conclusion. for these temperatures that I wanted to calculate. So xf is roughly equal to 1 over square root of gamma over hm. That's true for both with or without cannibalization. Xf prime will scale roughly as xf squared without cannibalization. But with cannibalization, it'll scale roughly as a log. Now, you can do this a little bit more carefully, keeping logs, evaluating stuff a little bit more rigorously, and you'll find these equations over here. You can understand the scaling of these equations just by these things over here. So we have that the rock density is proportional to xf, or square root of xf prime over sigma. The 1 over sigma appears over here. We have this 1 over gamma dependence in without cannibalization is because of xf prime, scaling like 1 over gamma, or 1 over square root of gamma. And the same with xf. Anyways, you can track through this thing and check that it's correct. It's indeed this is the scaling. With cannibalization, we have a different scaling on or a different dependence on the rate. Now, for comparison to understand what this looks like, for the WIMP scenario, we have that you can get the correct rock density for about 10 to the negative 36 centimeters squared cross section. And that's the factor we pulled out over here. So we're looking at rates that are pretty small. The rates that are of interest to us are fairly small. They're many orders of magnitude smaller than the masses. That's not too surprising. I told you that we wanted to have a rate smaller than Hubble. It's going to be a small rate. But nevertheless, it's pretty easy to conceive of such a model that'll have such a small rate. And I'll discuss that. I'll give you a model about this later on. OK, so here are the Boltzmann equations. Now, solving them is pretty straightforward. In the sense, or actually, you can solve these equations. It's not too hard. But in general, here's how they look like. And I just want to go over what each of these equations mean and where they come from. So first of all, you might be a little bit confused about this. I told you I have two different particles, but I wrote down three Boltzmann equations. And the reason is quite simple. We have a dark temperature here that does not equal to the standard model temperature. So you need one more equation to set your dark temperature. We got three variables, we need three equations, and that's what we have over here. The first Boltzmann equation just tells you that the number density of A will track the number density of B. That's why you have this NA squared minus NB squared over here. That's what this process does. The second Boltzmann equation tells you that the A and B system will decay through some rate, which I'm calling here gamma B, effectively equal to gamma. We can discuss the difference later if you're interested. Lastly, the energy density associated with this AB system will also drop exponentially, or will also drop because of this fact over here, very similar to the drop that happens here. But it's distinct in the sense that it's dependent on the dark temperature, and we can go ahead and calculate this dark temperature through these three equations. Now, as Robert mentioned, you can have matter domination in this system. So I've ignored that effect completely so far. But the point is that when you have dark matter that's not decaying or depleting until much after its mass, it can be, the energy density of this sector can be much larger than the standard model. And then you have matter domination. So this changes the rate at which the universe is expanding. And this is an important effect to take into account. There's also an additional subtlety here, and that's in converting time into temperature. If you if you remember from Coleman-Turner trying to solve Boltzmann equations, you had this dTs over here, and it was very easy to convert them into temperature, because all you did is just use some expression in Coleman-Turner. Now, it's a little bit more subtle here about how to do that, and the reason is conservation of entropy. Entropy is not conserved in the system. So you can't just swap temperature for time. You got to be a little bit more careful. And I want to go over how that works real quickly. So the idea is that,
you have a process that B decays into gamma, right? Mm-hmm. So it obvious that it's never relevant also, because there is also in principle then the process when B collides with the gamma, it gets converted.
Yes, into gamma, right? Yes.
So could it be that that process depletes B more efficiently than decays?
Well, it's not going to deplete B, right? If you have B, gamma, B.
No, but that's a way to lose B, right? So it's kind of...
Sorry,
gamma, you have B, mm-hmm. which instead of decaying in the vacuum, mm-hmm. it's a medium stimulated decay, right? So it collides with gamma and gets converted to gamma. So it's another way...
But it won't convert to gamma. It'll now I see what you're saying. Yeah, I agree with you, sorry. So in general, the couplings here are very, very small. We're talking about rates that are 10 to the negative 18. So I'll be very surprised whether any sort of effect like that could be very significant. I don't think that we...
The rate for the decay is set by the mass, so that if the mass is much larger, and when you rescatter, the rate for that will be set by the density of the gammas.
Right.
So depending on who is larger.
Right.
So I can imagine that in the regime when mass is much larger than you know, cubic root of the occupation number, that the decay will be more important. So, but it's
yeah, it's something to look into. I mean, one thing that we did look into, which is somewhat similar to what you said, so normally you'll also have 2-to-2 scatterings. So in principle, this will give you stuff like two particles coming in, two particles coming out from the exact same coupling. So typically those will be smaller because the number density kind of suppresses you enough, so that's subdominant to the decay, and you don't have to worry about those additional annihilations from B to B to standard model scattering.
Of neutrons after they freeze out is mostly given by the rescattering of neutrinos up until a certain moment, and then it will be given by the
decay.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, did you want to say something?
But it's just the mean, the cube root number density of the temperature here, and the mass is larger than the temperature.
That's right.
Well, mm-hmm. So decay
makes
it.
Yes. Okay. So you want to convert between time and temperature, and you need to find a way to do that quantitatively. And you can do that by this expression over here. So d by d, by d time is related to Hubble through d. This is just a chain. This is just the chain rule. And then you rewrite that in terms of Hubble. So really, if you want to convert a time derivative to a temperature derivative, you need to have one thing. You need the derivative of temperature with respect to the scale factor A. Now, in the usual case, what we do is we just have conservation of entropy. So dSA cubed, the total entropy of the universe, is a constant. So we can go ahead and rewrite this by using the typical expression for entropy, which is just that 2 pi squared over 45 g star s t cubed. So you can plug that into here and then take the derivatives. Now what you get is you find the derivative that's important in this little thing in red is just equal to minus the temperature of the universe divided by the scale factor. This is up to some this derivative of g star being equal to 0. But that's a detail. But the point is that you can convert, using conservation of entropy, this quantity, this d by dt, into a temperature derivative. Now, here entropy is not conserved. We're working in an out-of-equilibrium process. By definition, I told you that this thing's out-of-equilibrium. There's no chemical equilibrium between a standard model and your dark sector. So you've got to be a little bit more careful. But you can still find this derivative. It's given by the second law of thermodynamics, the heat change in the system, just dq over t. And we can rewrite this this q, this energy change, be equal to the density of the dark sector, a cubed. And this is something that we actually know. So this d, this energy, the derivative of the energy of the dark sector respect to a cubed, respect to a, is in fact given by the Boltzmann equations in the previous slide. So this is a well-known thing that we can plug in, and that's how we get this expression over here. Now, the details here are just plugging through a little bit of algebra, but the whole point is that it's under control. We have an entropy change in our system, but that's okay. We know how to track it, and that's how we can do it through here. Now, in effect, this effect is very small. It's an order one effect, but if you want to get things right to factors of two, this is an important thing to keep in mind. So here's the result of solving the Boltzmann equations. Here you see this is a solution for the yield, which is the number density divided by the entropy. In blue, we have the equilibrium distributions, and that just drops when you get to the mass of the particles. On the other hand, for the particles that we're interested in, these A's and B's, they'll delay. There'll be delay. So they won't start depleting until some point later, and this point will be at the start of decay. Again, just this time or this temperature T gamma. Then they'll just start to decay, but this exponential that I mentioned to you earlier. So I've given you the general framework. Now you probably the next thing to ask here is where can this take place? What are the constraints in this sort of system? And there are constraints in three different parameters involved here: the mass, the rate, and the cross section. But we can use the relic density constraint. In other words, the fact that we know what the relic density of this system is, given by this expression over here, we can use that expression to reduce the parameter space by one variable. So instead of having a three-dimensional exploration of the parameter space, we can only explore two dimensions. I'm going to focus on the case without cannibalization. It's going to be a little bit easier, but in general, we've done it for both, and I'll show you the results for cannibalization at the end as well. So we use this expression over here. If you set the relic density that you observe equal to the dark matter relic density, you'll find that the cross-section is given by some constant times m squared over gamma. So we'll use this constraint throughout to reduce the parameter space to a two-dimensional fit, or two-dimensional exploration. So the first constraint is the zeroth order thing you could do. It's in order for you to actually be out of equilibrium. I told you in the beginning this is one of the fundamental things that we're interested in. We're not interested about when the rate is small. Sorry, when the rate is large. We want the rate to be small. So this requires you to have this x gamma, in other words, when you start the decays, to be larger than 1, roughly. This condition is a little bit too weak. In reality, you don't want to have any thermal contact with a standard model. So you want to take x gamma roughly equal to 5. That's the more safer condition. And that's this line over here. So here on this plot, we have a plot of the gamma versus m plane. And this line over here shows you the constraint associated with this condition. Or actually associated with this condition, with a factor of 5. So that's the most trivial thing you could do. The next thing you want to do is to not spoil BBN. Or not be sensitive to effects after BBN. So in general, there are constraints from the CMB and other sources as well. And what they do is they measure an effective after BBN. And they're sensitive to any energy injections at this point. So if B was decaying past the mass of the electron, roughly, then what you're going to find is you're going to find deviations to the CMB, deviations of BBN, etc. So we wanted to avoid these constraints. So to be safe, as a rough bound, we just took that gamma be larger than the Hubble at ME. And that just tells you that this thing's going to be decaying before the mass of the electron. Sorry.
Sorry, can you carry on?
Mm-hmm. OK, that's it? OK, no problem. So that gives you this purple bound over here. So this is you can do this a little bit more carefully, but this is kind of just to be on the safe side, be well before BBN. The next thing that we looked into was unitarity. Unitarity is a little bit more subtle than maybe you naively expect. Basically, the thermally average cross-section is just given by this expression over here that was calculated by these guys. But it tells you that you have some kind of bound on your thermally average cross-sections in the early universe. This is just the typical thing you would do also in regular T equals zero physics. But there is an effect associated with, or you just expand it in the non-relativistic limit. You do multiply by velocity, and you get this limit over here. You can rewrite this limit in terms of the temperature of your dark sector, x prime. And then we get this result given over here. So your cross-section, the sigma that we have, is given by this expression over here. Now remember that I told you that this constraint, this relic density constraint, tells you that sigma will scale as m squared over gamma. And then you have, and then we also have that xf prime will scale like 1 over gamma. So in other words, if you go ahead and you plug both of these into here, you'll find this constraint is independent of gamma. And that's true. It's true particularly over here. Now, I kind of lied to you because it's actually not true over here. And that's because of matter domination. And that's why you see this plot curving around. There's some small effect here associated with matter domination, and that's taken into account in these constraints. But nevertheless, this thing is roughly independent of gamma.
Just to come back to the question, which got swallowed.
Sure.
So at higher masses, the energy injection would also potentially mess up BBN nuclear limits.
What do you mean by higher masses?
Higher masses of the dark matter, so you're injecting higher energy standard model particles.
So, but the oh, I see. So you're saying a heavy inject, like a.
You certainly can't inject a whole radiation degree of worth of freedom. You need to inject much smaller amounts of energy. So, presuming that would mean that higher masses, you need to have shorter decay times.
I see. So you're saying basically this is going to be going up a little bit, become a little more constraining. That's right?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I in general, I agree with you. We explored BBN a little bit, but in the end, we just left it as a simple constraint. But it's certainly possible this thing is too optimistic, and it should be shifted by maybe an order of magnitude or so, or depending on the range. Okay, possibly more. But, yes.
I don't know, you need quite a few e-folds to get down to the radiation free is free of work. You need to inject many orders of magnitude less than that, so you need quite a few e-folds. That's it. So it's order of magnitude is probably.
Okay, so that's unitarity. So now we have a little triangle, it tells us where we can live. The last thing to do is look at the indirect detection constraints. Now there's no constraints here from direct detection, and no constraints from collider physics. And the reason is very simple. We're focused on very small couplings here. That's one of the fundamental things. These rates are very tiny. But you can still have these indirect probes. And here you see how they look like. Now they're surprisingly powerful. And that's simply because we're looking at an enhanced thermally averaged cross-sections as opposed to the WIMP scenario. Basically, the longer you wait, the larger cross-section you're going to need to deplete your dark sector. So that's why these things are going to be curling up a little bit at higher masses. Now, we recast these limits for two different scenarios, where you decay entirely into E plus E minus and entirely into gamma gamma. And these are constraints arising from these papers over here. Now, if you stare at this, you might be a little upset about this gap over here in this recast. That gap is because we recast two different, we use two different papers and they use different thresholds, and we ended up with a gap inside our limits. But it's really not a physical thing. This gap should really be filled.
So did that have
sense from dark matter
emulation?
Yes, exactly. These are looking for AMS and other similar telescopes.
But it can be just a little bit heavier than the main.
Yes. So I'll go over the splitting in 1 second, and then we'll see how that works out, right? Yeah, so this whole discussion is still assuming that there's no splitting at all. I'll go over the effects of a splitting in a minute. So the idea is that A's can still annihilate into B's. And once the B number density drops, once you have the decay, there's still a preferential to go into the B's population. So the A's do still go into the B's. So similar to let's say, co-annihilation, where you have two things that are decaying at the same time. That are annihilating at the same time to produce the, or to go into the standard model. Like, it doesn't have to be a multi-step process. It can happen all together. And basically, if you compute the Boltzmann equations, or just look at this, what happens is that your entire population can't annihilate into these Bs, but enough of it does that you can still get depletion of your dark sector. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Exactly zero, and it still happens. That's right. So what's going to happen is you're going to have some sort of, So at temperature equal to zero, you're not going to have any annihilations. But because temperature is not equal to zero, you have a distribution, you have a Boltzmann distribution, and you could feed off part of your Boltzmann distribution in order to turn into this other particle, in this case, the B particle. No, so B's are going to be decaying, and A's are not coupled at all directly to the standard model. So the whole point is that A's are going to be stable, and they can be dark matter today, but B's are going to decay endlessly, and they're going to be suppressed.
How important is residual annihilation in the theory of the universe? So often there's a happens before BBM, but then after the elements form, you still have some
constraints from CMB.
So the B's are all depleted. So the B's are all depleted. So you can in principle have AA to BB. That's your friend? Mm-hmm. You can have those, yes. I mean, it's the same as the WIMP case. We can also have collisions after freeze out.
And CMB. No,
I thought you have a large cross section.
So the cross sections are, I mean, the thermally averaged cross sections are going to be larger, that's right.
So the CMB constraints at low masses are probably better.
Well, it's BBM peaks. Probably low masses are probably below 10 GeV, everything will be gone, right? Because the rates are going to be larger than
I mean, it's almost gone anyway. You probably just fill it back up.
What's
that?
It is not a complex
case.
Yeah,
it's still,
right?
It'll just fill in that little gap there, right?
Yeah, it's probably, we're suggesting that anything below 10 GeV will be gone because of the energy injection.
So looking for early time annihilations rather than late time annihilations.
Let me think about that. I don't have a quick answer for you, but we can look into that. Let me get back to you on that. So here's the general constraints. We see that indirect detection is very powerful, more than you'd expect. Now, but there's still some parameter space involved here that's free. Now, if you can compare this also to the case of cannibalization, so there's two different scenarios. Here you see cannibalization limits are a little bit weaker. There's also a more powerful unitarity constraint, so that kind of kills some of the parameter space on the high mass side. But either way, indirect detection is a powerful probe, but it's also model dependent. So it assumes on what kind of stuff you're decaying into that's going to change these sort of limits. And in general, there's still lots of open parameter space that you can live for these sort of things. Yes. OK, now so you guys asked this quite a few times, which is just a good question. It's what about the splitting? How can you assume the splitting? What are the effects of not having a splitting? Now, we made this big assumption that MA is equal to MB. This is natural if you have some symmetry that imposes this. But you can also have, at the very least, percent level splittings of these sort of things by loop corrections. So it's really important to understand then what are going to be the effects of having this splitting. And the effect is really dependent on whether you have MA larger than MB or MB larger than MA. Now, the key point is that the temperature of your dark sector is much smaller than the mass. So because you're non-relativistic, these effects can be very important, very large. In particular, whenever A is lighter than B, as I'll discuss. So the first case is a little bit simpler. It's when MA is heavier than MB. So in this case, A to BB is allowed at T equals 0. So you can have this process happening at all times, or this process can happen freely even at T equals 0. Now, if you have a small splitting, you have this relationship over here. You can relate your cross-section with MA heavier than MB very easily to your cross-section with MA equal to MB, but there's no dramatic changes. X prime is going to change the physics here depending on its size, but it's not going to be a huge impact on the qualitative behavior associated here. Now, on the other hand, if you do have a very large splitting, then it actually becomes a two-step process. Now, in this case, I think that what you were hinting at, happens here is that you have MA, and MB is much slower, is much lighter. So in this case, now the physics changes quite a bit. So before you get to the mass of A, you just have the regular story that I told you about before. Once you cross the mass of A, the A's will turn into B's. And this will happen until at some point, which is when this annihilations will freeze out. Now past this point, which presumably can be a little while after, then the B's will decay into the standard model. Now this has an important effect. It sounds relatively harmless, but it has the important effect that when the B's are decaying into the standard model, you can also heat up your standard model quite a bit. Well, not in practice, you don't actually heat it, but you just leave the temperature the same. And what happens is this dilutes the A population. So this gives you a very different rock density that you will get today because of this dilution from this decay into the standard model. This was studied in some detail in these papers over here, and that's this effect that's in general can change your rock density by orders of magnitude. But that's for the large splitting. For a small splitting, the effect is quite harmless. The other case, which is when A is lighter than B. So what happens there is the A to B process is forbidden at T equals 0. Now, in this case, you can no longer you no longer have large annihilations, but it all depends on the splitting itself. So this is discussed. This was an old idea discussed in detail in this paper over here from 1991, and kind of revived recently by these guys over here as well. But the idea is that most of your dark matter, most of the A's in this case, are not able to turn into B's. Only a small fraction of them are able to, and that's if they have large enough energy. So here you see a plot of the distribution function as a function of velocity. And basically, there's only some small amount of the tail that can have sufficient energy to produce the B's. And the thermally average cross-section will scale as a simple exponential. And this is going to suppress your thermally average cross-section quite a bit. So in general, this is quite similar to what these guys were discussing. But it has some new forms, which we want to look into a little bit more. And that's hopefully going to be a future study by myself and my collaborators. Okay, so lastly, I want to go over a model. I kind of focused on this toy model of A's and B's. I want to go over a more explicit version, which is hopefully a little bit more motivated, at least tells you why these things are degenerate. So here's the model we came up with. It has a dark SU2 gauge symmetry. In this case, we have a very standard model-like thing, so we're going to use standard model notation, but these will all be dark particles. Now we have a dark W, WD. We also have a dark Z, ZD. And the dark W plus minus will be linear combinations, or a linear combination of these W1 and W2. Now, electric charge here does not represent real electric charge. These plus minuses just represent some sort of isospin charge. We'll introduce a dark Higgs doublet, again, in close analogy with the standard model. And this phi d, this Lagrangian will look like this. Now, once this phi d gains a VeV, what will happen is the W's and D's, or these W's and Z, will gain masses, and they'll be identical. This is the same story as you get in the standard model. If you have no hypercharge, the W's and Z's are degenerate, up to loop corrections. So this theory has an accidental global custodial symmetry, which is very important. And it also, and there's also no breaking of the symmetry. So if you remember in the standard model, we have the custodial symmetry. We have breaking of the symmetry by different pieces, like the hypercharge, for example, and that causes loop-level breakings, and that creates deviations in what you'd expect based on a perfectly custodial symmetry. Now, this custodial symmetry is exact here, so we need some way to violate the symmetry if we want to have a decay. Any sort of decay operator that you can write down that's custodial invariant cannot produce these we'll violate custodial symmetry. And this theory has a good custodial symmetry. So the point is we have to produce some dimension 6 operator that can connect these two sectors. Here's the one that we came up with. It's just phi dagger phi with a d mu and for the dark sector. So it connects the two Higgs bosons of the standard model and your dark sector. This creates a mixing between Z and Z, the Z dark and the Z. And you can have a new decay channel now for the ZD. It can decay through mixing of the Z into the standard model. Now, this decay channel is still not open for WD because it has this isospin symmetry. This operator does not fully break the custodial symmetry. It breaks it down to a U1. So because ZD is a decaying particle and WD is a non-decay, is a stable particle, that means that we have some sort of B particle for ZD and some sort of A particle for WD. So it's a very it's very similar to the scenario that I just described to you earlier on. Here's some explicit numbers showing you how this plays out. So the W's can turn into Z's. This is one of the diagrams that that happen. There's also a bunch of other ones, about I think four other ones or three other ones at tree level. And we also have the K's of this dark Z into the standard model. If you go ahead and you compute these cross sections, it doesn't really matter, but here's the form that they take. It's a pretty straightforward exercise. Now, if you go ahead and check what is the size of number changing processes here, they're very important. So cannibalization will be the this thing will cannibalize throughout its history. And you can get the correct relic density today for a bunch of different numbers. But just to give you a benchmark point, if this dark matter mass is roughly a GeV, then you need to have a higher dimensional operator scale of about 10 TeV. So sorry, say one more time.
This the normalization scale on the 10 TeV will give it in the thermal contact with the standard model to quite low temperature.
So the mixing is still going to be small, even due to that that operator. So it won't be. I mean, it'll impact the results, but it won't be a large effect. I mean, the point is that this operator. I mean, the 10 TeV is not huge, but it's you also have a very small. Yes, I agree with you there, yeah. But it'll be the same temperature actually regardless of whether you have this interaction or not. So I agree with you, but it doesn't have a large effect on the actual physics. Yes. So that's what I wanted to say today. In the conclusion, in general, we have not seen any new physics on the dark matter side for a while now. The fact that we have not seen anything at the LHC in particular, I think should hint to, at least hints to me, that this WIMP paradigm is no longer as faithful as it used to be, and maybe we should explore other alternatives. And the mechanism that we discussed today was this co-decay mechanism, which can deplete any sort of dark sector and reduce its number density. In general, there's now a new parameter compared to the normal story. Now we have an additional decay rate compared to where we usually have just a cross-section, which determines your relic density. And there's still stuff to do. In general, we want to understand the model space. So we presented one model that we think is somewhat viable. It's interesting to understand what other kinds of models that you can build that have this phenomena. And also, as I mentioned, what we're interested to understand is forbidden regime and know what kind of physics this forbidden regime has in store. Thank you. Any questions? Yes, I'm in Toronto.
So, if anyone has an urge to get together and cannibalize something, so you know it.
Yes, if you want to discuss this or anything else, I'll be around for the rest of the day, and also anytime. I'd love to chat more about this. Thank you.
Thank you.